Welcome to QualityCast North, a podcast dedicated to showcasing healthcare quality improvement across northern British Columbia. Casting today from the traditional territories of the Kleklaytane and Tsingtian First Nations are your hosts.
I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
You're listening to QualityCast North. Our topic of today's interview is alcohol use disorder. This is one of the largest preventable contributing factors to emergency care encounters in our healthcare system, often on a repeated basis. The effects of alcohol use disorder come at high cost, not only to the healthcare system, but also to society and on a family and individual level. But there is good news. Over the last few years, effective treatments for alcohol use disorder have become available. But getting those open to treatment, connected with the resources to access this therapy, remains a logistical challenge. To talk about their excellent quality improvement work on this topic are our guests today, Dr. Erin Zidoff, the Medical Director for Emergency Services for the Interior Health Authority in BC, and Dori Fatik, a transformational lead for the Emergency Services Network in Interior Health. Welcome to the two of you. Thank you for joining us on today's podcast.
Thank you.
Now, before we get into your improvement work, I wonder whether you can just briefly introduce yourselves, your roles, and a little bit about the department and the city where you work. And maybe we'll start off with you, Dori.
Sure. Thank you. So I am a transformational lead for the Emergency Services Network for Interior Health. I currently living in Fernie on the unceded lands of the Tanaha peoples. I have been an emergency department nurse for the past 22 years, starting in pediatric emergency departments and transitioning to the adult EDs with my move to Interior Health in 2009. I've spent the last 5 years supporting our 28 emergency departments with initiatives such as this and with the most recent rollout of the alcohol use disorder in the emergency department program.
And you, Erin?
My name is Erin Zidoff. I'm calling in from the traditional ancestral territories of the Shuiten First Nations area here in the beautiful Shuswap, where I live with my wife and family. I've been practicing as an emerge physician for about 18 years and with family medicine as well at the early stages. I also have been serving as the medical director with the Emergency Services Network here in Interior Health for the last 5 years, and been working on various projects, including this one, which we're going to chat about today. And Dori and I are just two of the many people who did participate in this work. So just want to also acknowledge that this was a very large team that we had wrapping their arms around this work, and we're happy to sort of represent and share this work on their behalf as well.
Well, that's great. And it's great to have you here representing that work and that team. So thank you again for coming on. Now, before we actually dive into the work itself, I wonder if you can give us some background about alcohol use disorder, first of all. How do you define it? And what's the gap in care that prompted this work originally? Can you tell us, Erin?
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned at the beginning in your introduction, alcohol use disorder has a huge impact on health outcomes for patients and also for their families. And that, from a substance use perspective, is the biggest contributor to healthcare-related morbidity and mortality, as well as costs. The opportunity that has come up more recently is for outpatient management of alcohol use disorder, particularly with medications of naltrexone and acamprosate. These two medications have excellent number needed to treat for alcohol use disorder in the range of 1 in 12 for an effective impact on abstinence or reducing alcohol intake, which has tremendous potential. The challenge and the gap was that only about 2% of potential of patients who could be taking these medications are actually prescribed them. So we had a huge opportunity, and the emergency department is one of the places where these patients are often seen, sometimes their sole point of contact with the healthcare system, and especially in our current climate with limited primary care, we also serve that role for many patients as their only access point. So that's where the opportunity came and the opportunity that we leaned into as a group.
Excellent. So your work centers around a new care pathway, which is based primarily in the emergency department. And that might sound counterintuitive, because EDs are usually super busy places, often very oversubscribed, and often chaotic environments. So why did you choose to base this alcohol use disorder work here? Sorry?
That's a really great question with quite a simple answer, and I'll build off of what Aaron was saying. So we chose the ED because that's where the patients are. They come to us for help and we have it. We just aren't using it. This may be the only time a person accesses healthcare is in the emergency department. And the emergency department has been identified as a missed opportunity to help these folks. So I can give you a few stats on the why to help support this. And you touched on them in your introduction as well. So alcohol use disorder is severely undertreated, with less than 5% of people being screened yearly, where Health Canada recommends people be screened yearly. People with alcohol use disorder visit the emergency department almost five times more than the general population. 70% of emergencies with young people aged 12 to 24 involve alcohol use. 24 to 31% of patients treated in the ED and 50% of severely injured trauma patients have positive results when screened for alcohol problems. So again, this is a good place to start the conversation. And alcohol use contributes to a quarter of all toxic drug deaths in the BC.
Those are astonishing statistics, aren't they? That's incredible. I mean, I knew the numbers were quite large, but that is jaw-dropping. Yeah.
So let's start. Can you take us through your improvement work and the pathway you've built? And when you're doing that, like, what's the goal and how does it address the problems that you've mentioned earlier?
Well, this is a big question because it really leans into the scope of the work. Initiation of the project is really, you know, gathering our key partners at the table. And we gathered folks from patient partners or Indigenous partnerships, mental health and substance use expertise within addictions, as well as pharmacy and our MERGE colleagues. We brought frontline providers to the table, and we really sought to map this out. Number one, from a patient perspective, what does it feel like for a patient to walk through the emergency department, and what are the opportunities in that journey through their emergency visit to touch base with them and to see, even if they're there for a rolled ankle or a sore throat, is there an opportunity to provide some screening for substance use, including alcohol use disorder? So using our team, we really wrapped our heads around, you know, the patient journey, and sought to meet them at each point, because somebody may be diagnosed with alcohol use disorder through the DSM-4 criteria. However, they may have a different path. They may just have a diagnosis and not require hospitalization for withdrawal or anything like that, but they might require sort of some treatment center or some further engagement from that lens, or they might be needing some support through counseling and some addiction support as an outpatient. So there's multiple different pathways. So we really tried to address each potential part of a patient's visit in the work that we did. From the frontline perspective and the clinician perspective, we also tried to, emergency department is a very busy place, lots of activity. So trying to make this as clean and efficient as possible from the workflow lens was also one of our priorities. And also providing them with, the resources to do something with the information that they received. So for example, I'll walk us through our workflow. As patients come in, the screening point is not the triage nurse, but the primary care nurse area. And at that point, patients, if the opportunity arise, we try to do this with as many patients as possible, but we don't expect universal screening, but certainly our goal is as many as possible, and have an opportunity to have a conversation about some of their substance use history. If identified as high risk for potential alcohol use disorder, then the pathway goes down towards a physician who can then make that diagnosis. We have other care team members that are brought in, such as social worker or connections team at that point as well, if available in that emergency department. We then determine if an alcohol use disorder diagnosis is present. Then we would determine if they are, is there evidence of withdrawal or concern for withdrawal for this patient? And if there is, then we have to, we take them down a pathway, and we provided updated research and evidence-based order sets for both benzodiazepine and phenobarbital management of alcohol withdrawal. And these pathways would then, track down through either treatment center or possibly in inpatient management for more moderate to severe alcohol withdrawal. The The other option, of course, if a patient is not in withdrawal or at risk of withdrawal, then there's an opportunity to prescribe those medications that we spoke to, and that is the acamprosate or naltrexone. There are some other ones as well that are second line. And in order to help streamline that process, we created a templated prescription that physicians could use to prescribe those medications to those patients. And it included a patient-centered approach whereby, based on what the patient's desires were, are they desiring abstinence or are they desiring to reduce high drinking incidences or binge drinking? And what are the patient's goals? Depending on those factors, we guided the physician or the provider through the prescription to prescribe the right medication for that patient. And then each of those patients was also connected to a virtual addiction medicines clinic within 72 hours. The key part of this as well is patients that were able to be managed for their withdrawal as an inpatient also had opportunity to be accessing these medications and through to the virtual addiction medicine clinic. And then from that point on, if a local clinic was available or a primary care provider who was comfortable supporting ongoing prescribing of these medications, the patient would be connected with those services through the virtual addiction medicine clinic. But if they were not, particularly in some of our rural communities, we would continue to support the patient through that virtual clinic. If a patient was not identified with alcohol use disorder, but just had sort of been flagged for high use, alcohol consumption, there was an opportunity for a brief intervention as well to just talk through sort of the decisions around high use drinking and or high risk drinking and to review some of the potential health impacts of that. But at those at that junction point, of course, no medication is indicated, but certainly the counseling and the offering of further counseling and outpatient therapy, outpatient addictions counseling was put into place as well. So really, as you can see, we've tried to identify right from severe alcohol withdrawal all the way up through to moderate high risk drinking habits to try and provide the patients with a wraparound care as well as the providers with the full toolkit that they would need to potentially support bringing patients this opportunity to utilize or initiate on these very effective medications for reducing their consumption or possibly even abstinence if that's their goal.
Yeah, great example of how the pathway came through evidence-based and such. I really hear those underpinnings of motivational interviewing, like those, that whole approach, meeting the patient where they're at. And then of course, one of the follow-up questions on this is, or what are the benefits of doing it this way? I've heard several, but did you want to add on there the benefits of this approach that you've just outlined in the pathways?
Well, I think a couple of pieces that are key to this is the opportunity to really engage with the broad group of stakeholders, including our mental health substance use outpatient services, as well as our emergency department, to really provide that sort of full wraparound support. And again, the other piece that I think was really key to this is having patient partners. We had patient partners who were involved throughout to develop patient-facing materials to influence sort of the pathway and the workflow in itself, and even down to the way in which our screening questions were asked. Because there is significant challenges around some of those questions. If somebody walks into an emergency department and they have some trauma related to alcohol, to be sensitive and aware for that was really important in our process as well. So we really sought to be trauma informed and culturally safe in this work. And I think that was, we couldn't have done it without the engagement of our partners across the board. So I think the engagement piece, the partnership is the key. And then the wraparound support, so giving patients not just here's your prescription for outpatient medication, but because they could be on a continuum from not getting the diagnosis of alcohol use disorder or being in withdrawal, and providing that continuum, there's no line in the sand. So we needed to really provide the full package for both patients and for providers.
Yeah, and using this approach, this has clearly been a successful improvement initiative. But how do you go about measuring success?
Yeah, great question. We started early on, you know, that's another partner who we engaged with early on in this work was our evaluation team in Interior Health. And we really worked hard to identify what our goals were. And number one, as I've mentioned before, is patient experience, wanting it to be not only a culturally safe and, you know, trauma-informed experience, but also to make them feel like they were supported in their health journey and that it was useful for them. And so we carried out a number of patient surveys to evaluate patients who had been involved in these interactions. We identified about 22 patients in through surveys, and were able to get actually some really beautiful feedback from patients and really feeling like they were well supported. They really appreciated the approach and felt like they were in a culturally safe and trauma-informed environment. So I'm not going to say that happens all the time, but for the patients in the surveys, for the majority of them, they really felt like that approach was really beneficial for their healing journey. So that's the first piece. The other piece is, was it effective? You know, did we achieve our goal? And of course, there are, like I said, this is a big project because there's lots of pieces. The part we really, you know, we're kind of queuing in on this quality piece, as I mentioned earlier, was, are we making a difference in terms of getting more patients set up with the prescriptions for outpatient management of alcohol withdrawal or alcohol use disorder, sorry. And in that capacity, we actually were able to get some data from the health data portal within the province on PharmaNet data. So we were able to track of the patients who came through the program. We track, we're continue to add numbers to the list, but at the point of the evaluation, had about 176 patients come through, and about, you know, 56% of those at one time in the 90 days after their visit to the emergency department filled the prescription for naltrexone or etomprazine. And further to that, you know, at 90 days, we were able to identify that about 25 of those patients were retained in treatment on those medications at 90 days post their emergency department visit. So it was really, for our team, that was really amazing to see that sort of opportunity and to continue to see our numbers. I think we're up probably over 350, maybe close to 400 patients who have been through the program now. We continue to track it as it goes on. So that was another really strong piece of the evaluation that came through, and another part which we did to just to make sure we're sort of capturing all the elements is the implementation is a huge part of this. And what is the experience of the implementation from our frontline? So from our nurses and our physicians, did they feel like they had the information they need? Did they feel like it was useful? And did they feel like they were more or better prepared to support patients with a diagnosis of AED. So in that work, we found throughout our implementation that we were able to improve that through a couple of PDSA cycles and you know, some key pieces being, as Dory mentioned, in-person support was critical, as well as sort of the ongoing sort of follow-up and reaching out to them. We had multiple forms of education opportunities throughout. And then bringing pizza for the physicians, I think, was probably one of the highlights as well, of course.
This, Aaron's spoken about this new pathway, and it's clearly been successful, and also about how it spread across multiple sites within your health region. How many sites? We're curious about that implementation piece. Like, how many sites did it spread to, and roughly how long did that take? You know, we understand it's a process, but super interesting.
Right. So we have 28 emergency departments in Interior Health, so a lot, and we did it over the course of 11 months. So from July 2023 to June 2024. So in hindsight, we should have stretched it over 18 months. I was away from home for a lot of those 11 months. So it was great work. It was a lot of work, but we should have stretched it out. So in learning going forward, more projects like this will take a little bit longer.
That's astonishing, I have to say. The implementation across that many sites in that length of time is astonishing work. And that's probably a testament to the success of the pathway itself, but also to probably to the process that you developed for implementation, which I think is often a challenge, right, when spreading quality improvement projects. I wonder if you could just take us through your implementation process. What steps do you take to say, bring on a new facility on board with this new pathway?
Sure, I'll do my best over voice. It'd be nice to share some photos or some images, but unable to do that. So working with our project manager, Dita, we broke the rollout into manageable phases based on our geography. So, and we had to simply do this because of the overall size of Interior Health region. So I don't know if you know, but Interior Health covers an astounding 215,000 square kilometers. So we're big. So we broke it down into seven phases. So we had anywhere from 3 to 6 sites a phase. So then for each phase, Dita would set up an introductory call with the site's ED leadership, which included the site director, ED manager, ED educator, if they had one, their charge nurses. So during this call, it was about 30 minutes. We gave a high level introduction to the program, what they would expect, answer any questions. And we had a brief discussion about a go live day, we gave them a window of, you know, when I would be in the area and discussed like when would be the best for everybody to come. And then once that was decided, about 2 weeks out, we would set up another call, usually just me, but sometimes Dita would attend too, with just the ED educator and charge nurses. And it would be more of an education call. So we would have a slide deck where we would go over the steps of the entire program, basically what Aaron has discussed in the previous questions there, but we had it laid out strategically so they could follow along and, you know, show them we built a toolkit and just kind of go over like the full ins and outs of the program and answer any of their questions that they had. And then during the go live dates, I would attend each site in person to socialize the program with the frontline staff, to answer any questions or kind of quell any misinformation that was kind of going through the pipelines there. And then also knowing that the ED is an unpredictable place in regards to busyness and staff availability, I had to be flexible in my approach. So at some sites, I would attend their morning safety huddles and I would be given 5 minutes to present. Other sites, I'd roam around and engage staff one-on-one when they had a spare minute at their workstations. And I also built, or Dean and I built hard copies of our package where the staff could go through at their leisure and see all the resources we had instead of being directed just to our electronic version online, which sometimes you never get to a computer outside of charting during a busy ED shift. So then at the end of every phase, Dita and I would discuss and look for ways to improve on the next phase before we rolled out and if there was any misses or lessons learned. And then we'd carry on. So, but then on the physician side, because they're just as important as the nurses, if not more so with some of this stuff, because they're the one doing the diagnosis, we identified a physician champion. So, who is usually someone who is passionate about addictions medicine. And then for each phase, so the group of hospitals, whether it's 3 to 6, I could work with that physician champion and then set up lunch and learns or journal club meetings in person for that physician to attend with if it was possible.
You really have a thought out process for that. And it always sounds like you could actually iterate that process and improve it each time you put on a new site. I'm interested actually, because every site and its community staff and patients, you know, they're going to be different from one another in size, in demographic, perhaps in their geography and the amount of resources they have. So what challenges, that must bring challenges, right, to a successful implementation. And how do you address those challenges?
Like you mentioned, constant tweaking of the rollout. Also knowing what services are available in each community and being okay with things not going as planned. So one example I can give, I was invited to the mental health day for emergency nurses at one of our bigger centers to present on this topic in order to hit as many nurses as I could in the emergency department instead of just going to their huddles. Like it was kind of an in-service day for them. Well, it didn't go as well as was attended. A lot of other hospital staff attended with some of our BC Ambulance colleagues, but only one emergency nurse attended out of 250. So that was, it was a really big disappointment. So, but I had to shift and went back to the department and spent an extra week and returned to the morning huddles and one-on-one style of rolling this out to get as many people as I could. And then again, with the sheer size of IH, it makes everything a bit challenging. But overall, like you mentioned, the rollout really was a rinse and repeat. We just needed to adjust for site-specific needs.
Excellent.
Yeah, and I think too, sometimes like the way a workflow happens in an emergency department from a triage nurse to primary nurse, physician, that's pretty standard. You know, that doesn't change whether you're in Chase or in Kelowna. You know, it's the same rhythm. I think what's the bigger pieces that would change would be, particularly around the discharge pieces, the disposition, and what resources are available in that community. And we really worked hard to connect, to continue to maintain those bridges because, physicians, nurses have been discharging patients with alcohol use disorder for years. So, they have their processes, their practices, and our intention and our approach was to do a quality plus, so you're doing great care. Here's how we can add to help improve it more. We came in with that intention, with that sort of approach, which is much more of a collaborative way than saying your guys aren't doing it the right way. Here's how you need to do it. So we really intended to sort of come from underneath and really support and improve that work. So it did look a little bit different from site to site, but overall, in the end, the core pieces, we're seeing referrals from every site across Interior Health. So. So that's for us, that's the win, is to say, hey, you know what, however they're doing it, we're still seeing patients sort of entering into this this pathway and having an opportunity to be for access to these medications, which can change a life. So
sure. And it's clearly been a lot of work for your team to do this, and you're right, it's that having that bespoke sort of implementation really is probably the key success for individual sites with their individual demographics and challenges there. That's interesting. And am I right in thinking that the virtual clinic supports the whole of the region? Is that right?
Yeah. And I have to, compliment our mental health substance use, transformational team and the work that they've done around that clinic. It's phenomenal. They have created that space for referrals from the emergency department within 72 hours. And Our in our data, in our evaluation, we evaluated and 76% of the time they actually connected with those patients within 48 hours. So they superseded that, and it's challenging because we send a referral that has a patient's phone number, email, best contact, and as it goes with patients and contacting them, it's not always easy. The phone number doesn't work, so there's challenges, but they're very good at sort of connecting with them, and their team has been phenomenal. So really couldn't have done this work without them.
Yeah, that's the great team approach.
So what have you learned from doing this work? You've mentioned a few things about flexibility and coming in with that quality plus, not like, we are the experts, but what other things would you like to share with us that you've learned from doing this work? And what have you got out of it on a personal level?
I can start. So like for me, it was a sense of accomplishment of a job well done. And again, as Aaron said, like it wasn't me, it was the team, but it was a job well done. And I was a part of that. We're doing meaningful work in the emergency services network at IH that's getting noticed. And we are an innovative partner with Quality Health Improvement for healthcare delivery in BC. Going in person to our sites gave us the ability to meet and connect on a personal level with all of our frontline ED clinicians. It's huge. It shows we care and that we're listening. It makes a difference to see a live, breathing human to interact with. I firmly believe that. And nobody reads their emails. And trying to get someone to break away to come to a virtual meeting, there's no food there, so why would you come? I'm embarking on another project with the Emergency Services Network, and I'm using how we rolled out the AUD program to mirror this new work. So far, so good. And just one last point that came to me, I think would be amiss if we didn't acknowledge Dr. Jeff Harries, who really was the pioneer and champion for this work, which we were able to then take his work and scale to our entire health authority because of his work in the South Okanagan and with the Canadian Alcohol Use Disorder Society. So we need to shout out Dr. Harries.
It's been incredible working with so many people. I think the team approach is really key to this work, and we really enjoy that, building those relationships and taking the time to think compassionately about each other, about the patients who we are going to be connecting with through this work, and also the providers, and really, lends itself to sort of an approach that that is fulfilling, both from our perspective and from the hopefully from the side of the people receiving the implementation, as well as the care that results of it. So I think those have been some really beautiful pieces of it. And as Dory mentioned too, in person, getting there on the front lines and having champions that really can help drive this work, that is a key piece, especially when you're seeking to do this from a regional lens, and you don't have that sort of one-on-one relationship doing it at one department. So really that distributed sort of leadership model, distributed project model is important for connecting, making those connections on the front line.
Well, thank you for that. I think this is phenomenal work. And I think both of you and your entire team should be extremely proud of what you've managed to achieve through this work. And I agree, it's extremely rewarding being part of a big team that meets its goals and then smashes them through the roof as you've done. So it's such a successful and widespread implementation. And I would like to be able to stay and talk for this a bit longer, but unfortunately we have to wrap things up. I can hear the closing music, which means we just have to give a big thank you to both of you, Dr. Erin Zaidoff and Dori Fazek, for being our guests today. We'll be sending both of you one of our exclusive and highly coveted QualityCast North coffee mugs as a token of our gratitude. And we'll also make sure that the documentation for the pathways and the assessments and any other literature that you feel would be useful for other sites who might be interested in taking up this work and treatment pathway, we'll make sure they're on our show notes as well on our website. But for now, it's goodbye from us. I'm Cher Chewy.
And I'm Lee Cameron.
And you've been listening to QualityCast North. If you enjoyed today's episode, check out our other episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts, and subscribe to our channel. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a question for us about healthcare quality improvement, email us at qualitycomms@northernhealth.ca, and your question could feature on a future episode. QualityCast North is sponsored by the Physician Quality Improvement Initiative, or PQI. PQI is a flagship program of the Specialist Services Committee, a collaboration between the Provincial Ministry of Health and the Doctors of BC, with representation for the provincial health authorities. This episode was co-produced by Dr. Cher Chewy and Lee Cameron, with technical support from Levi Giles and Matt Walker of Expression North. Original music by Daniel Chewy. Further information about today's guest is available in our show notes on our website at nhpqi.ca.